please.
The time certain item 1087, further extend the housing emergency to address continuing homelessness issues, identify council powers, specify an 18-month duration, and waive portions of the zoning code.
Colleagues, we're proposing an 18-month extension of the housing emergency that was first declared.
Together, Mayor?
No, we're reading it separately.
Okay.
That was first declared in 2015. Since first declaring the state of emergency, we've made significant progress to address the housing and homelessness crisis. We've increased shelter, and the number of unsheltered people sleeping on our streets has decreased. There are 2,200 affordable housing units currently in the pipeline through both an increased funding strategy and streamlining the permitting process. We've passed a number of additional tenant protections, from inclusionary housing to mandatory 90-day notice to mandatory relocation assistance. And we're currently finalizing the strategy to construct, acquire, or rehabilitate an additional 1,300 units thanks to the $258 million affordable housing bond voters approved last year. But there's more we need to do to stabilize the systems that impact housing and homelessness in our community. Rents continue to increase, and families continue to be faced with difficult decisions, like whether to take a 20% rent increase or move 45 minutes further away, whether to pay their phone bill or their rent this month, or whether to sleep on the street or stay with an abusive partner. This is an emergency that requires action now. This housing emergency is not just a theoretical concept. It's a practical set of land use and regulatory tools that we can use to address both housing and homelessness in our community. This ordinance asks the Portland Housing Bureau and the Joint Office to help us determine criteria which indicates when we can end the housing emergency, as well as a plan to get us there. I also want to acknowledge the typo in the FIPIS, at the end of the original announcement, which had the incorrect date listed for the extension. It's corrected here in the code, and the intention is to extend this policy out 6 months to April of next year, 2018, just to clarify. I'd now like to ask Commissioner Fish. He has some comments he'd like to make up front, and if anybody else has any comments they'd like to make up front, that would be great too. Commissioner Fish.
Thank you, Mayor. Mayor and colleagues, today and over the next few weeks.
That's correct, yes.
And
the typo correcting my typo has a typo. It is 18 months. Sorry. Commissioner Fish.
Thank you, Mayor and colleagues. Today and over the next few weeks, we are poised to take four important actions to address our housing crisis. I support all of them. Extending the housing state of emergency by 18 months, extending the renter relocation ordinance, developing a roadmap for how we spend the housing bond, and setting a bold vision for boosting the supply of permanent supportive housing, deeply affordable housing with the services that people experiencing mental health crisis and addiction so desperately need. These are very important steps, and I am grateful for the leadership of the mayor, each of my colleagues, and the activist community. But we still have more to do. I believe we should make the renter relocation ordinance permanent and should do so this calendar year. And I will push for continued funding for the Joint Office for Homeless Services during our normal budget process. We are not the only city on the West Coast experiencing a housing crisis. But we have an opportunity to be a leader in supporting innovative, compassionate, and cost-effective solutions to that crisis. Thank you.
Thanks, Commissioner. Anybody else? Commissioner Daly.
Thank you. I don't have any prepared remarks. I just want to acknowledge the housing advocates in the room who were the ones that first called our housing state of emergency. And I want to appreciate the council for hearing that cry. It's hard to believe that it's only been 2 years. That was really a turning point in my life as a housing advocate when Justin Burry from Community Alliance of Tenants reached out to me and other housing rabble-rousers and kind of invited us into the fold, and our joint effort made the first noticeable difference in this crisis. So thank you, Mayor, and I look forward to, well, I don't look forward to the crisis extending, but I look forward to the emergency measures we're taking, staying in place.
Very good. With that, we'll introduce Mark Jolin from A Home for Everyone in the Joint Office of Homelessness Services and Kurt Krieger, the Director of the Portland Housing Bureau. Come on up. Thanks, gentlemen, for being here.
Good morning, Mayor, members of Council, Kurt Krieger, Director of Portland's Housing Bureau. It's my pleasure today to speak in favor of this extension. I'd like to speak to two aspects. One is the 180-day review by which the Housing Bureau and the Joint Office of Homeless Services will derive what we think are appropriate metrics to end the housing emergency. This was discussed during our budget process for the 2018 budget. I think with the Council Budget Office and OMF, we're both involved in that effort. We want to make sure it's an open, transparent conversation. We'll be especially looking at not just metadata like vacancy rates by income quartile, but also particular subpopulations, ethnic minorities, sexual minorities, and needs by gender, because there's a huge difference across the spectrum. Now that we're doing the point in time annually, I think we'll have better data and more frequent data inputs for that purpose. The other thing I'd like to underscore is the value of some of the more subtle aspects of the state of emergency. The process improvements that have been created by working together amongst and across bureaus, the Bureau of Development Services, the Housing Bureau, the Bureau of Transportation, Environmental Services, and Water especially, to help accelerate the velocity of permit approval for affordable housing projects has been very, very important. Under Commissioner Saltzman, we increased the pipeline by, we essentially doubled the pipeline, and we're going to double it again. And it doesn't do a lot of good to appropriate the money without seeing the actual end product as quickly as possible. So I'm pleased that our sister bureaus have been very cooperative. I do think that the state of emergency has sharpened everyone's focus because everyone has proprietary priorities of their own. And in this particular instance, the state of emergency has really helped. So I think things like design review, I know, are kind of inside baseball, but the fact that we now have faster ways by which to gain permit approval is profoundly important for the people that will ultimately live in these properties. Thank you.
All right. Good morning, council members. I'm Mark Jolin. I'm the Director of the Joint Office of Homeless Services. I appreciate the opportunity to come and speak a little bit about what we've been able to accomplish thus far under the state of emergency and why we need to continue this. When you first declared the state of emergency 2 years ago, you gave us important tools, financial resources, and critical focus to move forward a set of strategies to address the homeless and housing crisis in our community. Since that time, the city and the county have worked together in an unprecedented way and in partnership with community-based organizations, advocates, business leaders, philanthropists, and the faith community to expand the resources available to people facing homelessness. With the declaration of the state of emergency, you joined the county to increase total investment in homeless services by 40%, $20 million a year, in addition to the large increases in housing development investments. With the investments in homeless services and the tools provided by the state of emergency, we've expanded services rapidly. In the past 2 years, we've been able to open and help open 6 year-round emergency shelters with over 650 beds of capacity. That includes a new 90-bed women's shelter, a new 120-bed shelter for couples and women, a 30-bed veteran shelter, a new 200-bed shelter for adults that prioritizes women, couples, the elderly, and disabled, a new 14-bed village for women in the Kenton neighborhood, and a year-round 120-bed shelter for families that also serves several hundred additional people a night in with overflow capacity. We've also added 50 beds in motel rooms for women and children fleeing domestic violence. In addition, with the help of partners from the business community, each winter we've been able to open several hundred beds of additional temporary shelter. As a result, since the declaration of the state of emergency, we've been able to help since the declaration of the state of emergency, we're now able to help over 8,000 people a year access shelter. Prior to the declaration of the state of emergency, that number was around 4,000. Beyond shelter, we've been able to expand successful programs and introduce new programs to prevent people from entering the shelter system. An expanded shelter diversion program for the family system and for the domestic violence system helped several hundred families avoid having to come into shelter last year. A new partnership with the workforce system last year helped dozens of families who were participating in workforce programs to avoid losing their housing so that they could successfully complete their training and find living wage jobs that actually pay the rent. There's a new program that focuses on helping African-American men coming out of the criminal justice system called Flip the Script. It connects them with the housing, treatment, and employment services they need to avoid being discharged into homelessness. And there's a new housing stabilization team at the County Department of Human Services that helps their aging and disabled clients avoid losing their housing. As a result of these expanded and new program investments, last year we increased the number of people who received prevention assistance by 33% to 6,000 individuals. And we've made similar progress on our ability to place people off the streets and out of our shelters. We've more than doubled the number of housing placement workers doing outreach to camps and shelter in the last 2 years. We have a specialized mental health outreach team. We have culturally specific outreach to the Native American, African American, and Latino communities. We have teams specialized in serving women with histories of domestic violence. We have a team that's out there recruiting private market landlords. And we're offering increased access to employment services and benefit services. As a result of all of these efforts, the publicly supported nonprofits in our community last year helped more than 4,900 people move off the streets, out of shelter, and into permanent housing. That's a 65% increase over where we were 3 years ago, the year before the declaration of the state of emergency. All of this is good progress, and yet the housing and homeless crisis continues for low-income people, disabled people, our seniors, and especially for communities of color. The most recent point in time count made it clear. While we can appreciate that our unsheltered number was down by 11%, an outcome that defied the trend of double-digit increases up and down the West Coast, there were still conservatively over 1,600 people entirely unsheltered on one night in February in our community. And importantly, the overall homeless population continued to grow, nearly 10% over the past 2 years. And we saw a particularly dramatic increase, about 24%, in the severely disabled long-term homeless population. And over 70% of that chronically homeless population was still unsheltered. Within this increase, there are other disturbing trends, especially the continued significant overrepresentation of communities of color in the homeless population. Nowhere was this more evident than within the Native American community, which makes up 2.5% of Multnomah County's population and about 10% of the HUD homeless population. What this data tells us is that while we have made progress on improving shelter access overall, that work is not done. We still have too many highly vulnerable people unsheltered, and we need to fully stabilize the shelter capacity that we've created. And critically, we continue to be in a situation where each day more people are becoming homeless and ending up on our streets and in our shelters than are able to escape homelessness. For all the progress we've made on prevention and placement, we need to use the continued declared state of emergency to sustainably improve the ability of our shelters, especially our low-barrier shelters, to help people move out of them and back into permanent housing, to reduce the number of people who are leaving the hospitals, the mental health system, the criminal justice system, and the foster care system, and winding up on our streets, to strengthen the integration of our homeless interventions with mental health, addiction treatment, education, and employment services, to expand the targeted interventions for communities of color that are overrepresented in the homeless community, to expand our targeted housing and support service interventions for chronically homeless people, including, importantly, the expansion of supportive housing. And finally, to take the financial and regulatory steps to ensure that very low-income households can remain in the housing they have and to increase access to deeply affordable housing units for families and individuals who are homeless today or become homeless tomorrow. The Joint Office will, as directed in the ordinance, work with the Portland Housing Bureau over the next 6 months to articulate the criteria for determining when we no longer find ourselves in a state of emergency with respect to housing and homelessness. But right now, the crisis clearly continues, and extending the declared state of emergency recognizes that we must continue to prioritize the critical work of sustainably expanding and improving our local response to the housing and homelessness crisis.
Thank you. Appreciate that. And we also have an invited panel. So if you gentlemen want to cool your heels for a bit, we have Sharon Myron. She's Multnomah County Commissioner, District 1. Michael Buonocore, the Executive Director of Home Forward. And Will Harris, who's the Deputy Director of JOIN. Come on up and welcome. Thanks for being here. We sure appreciate it. Commissioner, do you want to go ahead and start?
Yes, thank you. Thank you for having me here today, Mayor and Commissioners. For the record, my name is Sharon Myron. I am the Multnomah County Commissioner for District 1. And I want to just briefly discuss the work that the county and the city are doing together to expand shelter, streamline homeless services, and get thousands of people into permanent housing. I want to acknowledge up front that I think the most important voices we will hear today are those of people with lived experience of homelessness or housing instability. Those voices, those experiences, they demand that we respond with care, urgency, and meaningful investment. To that end, over the past 2 years, I'm not sure, I keep fading in and out. I'm not.
You're actually up too close. To
I'm too paradox. Close.
Yeah, too paradox. Oh.
Thank you. To that end, yeah. Over the past 2 years, Multnomah County has worked closely with the City of Portland and several community organizations, along with advocates, business leaders, and others, to expand shelter beds, prevent homelessness, and secure permanent housing for individuals and families throughout our community. And though it is clear that people are suffering and we have so much work to do, as Mark Jolin just so eloquently stated, last year we saw record housing placements and shelter access. Thousands of people throughout our region got back into housing, found a safer night of sleep, or were kept from becoming homeless in the first place. But at the same time, we're seeing progress, as Mark Jolin also described, we are also seeing how much work remains to be done. The gap between wages and housing costs continues to widen in Multnomah County, and this pressure is especially acute for our lowest income residents. What sticks out to me in particular is that our progress on shelter, on housing, and prevention hasn't been experienced equally by all of our Multnomah County neighbors. The 2017 point-in-time count of homelessness in Multnomah County tells us that people with disabilities and people who are chronically homeless are making up a larger share of our unsheltered homeless populations than they ever have before. These are often people who struggle with health and addictions issues that complicate efforts to get them into and keep them stable in shelter and housing. As I think all of you know, I am an ER doctor, and these are the people that I see regularly, all too frequently in the emergency department. They're people in mental health crisis, people cycling in and out of our criminal justice system, people with chronic physical health conditions, including substance abuse disorder, and people with complex medical needs. They're people who need housing to be able to get healthy, but who often have very, very few housing options available to meet their needs. We cannot leave them behind. These are some of our most vulnerable residents, and their suffering compels an immediate need to respond with compassion and to provide adequate, safe, and habitable shelters and to rapidly increase the supply of permanent, affordable, supportive housing. It's clear to me that our housing crisis continues to be a true emergency. The action you're considering today will help us respond swiftly and humanely to this crisis. And thank you again for your time.
Thanks, Commissioner. We appreciate all your great work and your important perspective on this.
Thanks.
Michael, you want to go next?
Absolutely, Mayor Wheeler. Commissioners, thank you for having me here this morning. My name is Michael Buonocore. I'm the Executive Director of Home Forward. We're the housing authority that serves the City of Portland and Multnomah County. Commissioner Udaly, thank you for honoring the memory of Justin Bury here today. His memory continues to inspire me, and it's right that we remember him now. In addition to being the executive director of Home Forward, importantly, I am also a mentor. You may know this because I talk about it as annoyingly frequently as possible to encourage other people to become mentors. Check out itsbigtime.org to learn more. And so my little brother and I started a ritual last year. He's a junior in high school now. Where on Wednesday mornings I will pick him up and we'll go get coffee and catch up. And then I bring him to school where he has a late start on Wednesdays. So yesterday evening I texted him and I said, "Hey, unfortunately I have to drop you off at school and skip coffee in the morning. I have to hurry to get to City Hall." And he said, "Okay, that's fine." And I said, "See you in the morning. Seriously, sorry. I'd much rather hang out with you." Sorry. And he said, "Yeah, it's no problem. What are you doing at City Hall?" And I said, "Testifying that they should extend the housing emergency. The mayor asked me to be there to support it. It's definitely still an emergency. It basically means the city officially recognizes there are too many people without a safe place to live, and they need to keep doing as much as possible." And he said, "That's cool. What are they going to try to do about it?" And I said, I had to think about this one for a minute. I said, spend more money than they usually would for shelters and housing for people and have fewer dumb rules that make it harder to help people. Lol. And then I thought, well, I just educated the kid and wrote my testimony all in one text, calling it a day. But in all seriousness, in addition to the demonstrable need that we all see, there's no question that the need still exists to consider this a crisis and an emergency. I think what is less obvious is that our federal resources are less available than they have been when this crisis started. When we were regularly pulling families off of our housing choice voucher waiting list, about half of them were leaving homelessness. This past January, we stopped pulling names from our housing choice voucher waiting list. It's frozen for the foreseeable future because our federal funding is not keeping up with the cost of rents. In our housing portfolio, which includes deeply subsidized public housing as well as affordable apartments for folks with slightly higher incomes, our vacancy rates are over 98%, sometimes creep over 99%. So there's not a lot of movement in the stock of about 6,500 apartments that are also a really important resource in helping people get safely and permanently housed. So I wanted to just offer that perspective. I think in spite of what is a really terrible time in our community, I think thanks to the city and the Housing Bureau, we are seeing more groundbreakings happening, and we know that more affordable apartments will come online. I remain optimistic that we will come to our senses nationally and appropriate more money for voucher funding. And there's more good work happening around renter protections and prevention work to keep people who are in housing stable where they are. So I am proud to stand with some really brilliant and passionate people in this community to do everything possible. And I thank you for your commitment.
Thanks, Will. I'm sorry, Michael. Thank you. Will, you're up next. Thank you.
My name is Will Harris. I'm the deputy director at JOIN. You've heard from a lot of folks already this morning about the importance of the housing emergency and the declaration, its extension. I hope you'll take my testimony coming from people you've tasked with doing the work on the front line and our recognition that you rightly identified a housing emergency when you originally declared this back in October 2 years ago. That emergency still exists. It's not done. And we see the urgency of the emergency every day in the interactions we undertake with people experiencing homelessness on the streets of our neighborhoods. We feel the scope of the emergency in the tempo of our own work, where we're housing these days twice the number of people that we did in 2013. We understand in higher move-in costs, where we're facing double, sometimes triple deposits just to affect the transition into private market housing. And we felt it among those already stably housed who are having their tenancies threatened by the increases in rent. You know these things. You've heard the you've heard the statistics on it. But we feel it even personally with joint staff members who have received no-cause evictions. So plainly put, the housing emergency still exists. From our perspective, the original declaration played an important role in focusing efforts and resources and improving outcomes and enhancing service provisions. Mark Jolin spoke eloquently about that. One tangible representation of this service innovation and enhancement is Joins InReach program. This is a multi-agency effort bringing together a diverse number of services to affect housing placement out of safety off the street locations and emergency shelters. So we're leveraging services by housing people, creating new opportunity for others to access those emergency services. What we know is that over the last 20 years of joint street outreach, being out on the street, creating relationship with the folks that are struggling to survive, these people that we see on the streets of our city desperately are looking for the tools needed to end their homelessness. We see the extension of the declaration providing three areas that can enhance those tools that we've already built upon. The first tool we need is more housing. We are scouring the county looking for opportunities for the people that we're working with to place them, to secure housing placement. It's expensive. Because in this market, there just are not units that exist. So our hope is in this declaration that you will continue to streamline processes, that we can accelerate the pace of housing development. We need thousands of units annually to meet the needs of the people that are on the street. We need supported housing units that have the services attached to them, but we also need simply more units of all types that are focused on 0 to 30% MFI for singles and individuals, one bedrooms and three bedrooms. Additionally, this point has also been made, but in this market, we need more robust tenant protections. Join does have a program that conducts outreach to landlords, recruits them, and tries to retain them by making a business case to them that it's important to work with us. That case is extremely difficult to make in this market. So we see tenancies threatened by what the landlord sees as opportunity in the market. We need robust tenant protections to balance that, and we need additionally education about those protections with tenants and with landlords. Landlords who would do the right thing if they were actually aware of all the protections that the tenants faced. And finally, when we do all this, when we think about innovation, when we think about new service enhancements, we need to continue to build on what we have done so successfully in creating mental health access to mental health services and addiction treatment opportunities, in the housing outreach and housing placement assistance that we provide, and in employment support. These are the things we need to continue to do. This has to be an and proposition, not either or. So I thank you for your time this morning. You heard wonderful testimony. We urge you to extend the declaration. We think it's important. We think it's a community statement, and we think it's effective. Join looks forward to the important work in front of us.
Thanks, Will. And Commissioner Myron and Michael, thank you both as well.
Thank you.
Thanks for your testimony. How many people do we have signed up for public testimony?
43.
Okay. Let me do this. Yes, sir.
My guess is if people signed up for both.
I only had one sign-up sheet for both items.
So let's do this. Let's go ahead and also read 1088, please.
Okay. 1088, extend sunset of mandatory relocation assistance for involuntary displacements of tenants under affordable housing preservation and Portland renter protections.
So let me just give a brief statement on 1088, and that way if people want to testify, they can testify either on the emergency extension or on the relo. Colleagues, recognizing that the costs of involuntary displacement burdens residents, increasing the risk of homelessness and poverty, earlier this year, the City Council passed a temporary mandatory relocation assistance program. While we've been aggressively advocating in the Capitol for additional tools like Just Cause Eviction Standard and rent control that could help us address our housing emergency faster, we know there are tools we currently do have that can help us make significant progress. Mandatory relocation assistance is one of the most important tools we have at our disposal. We're now working to finalize the details of a permanent policy. However, the current policy is set to expire on October 6th. Given our commitment to meaningful public engagement for housing policy, this extension provides us time to finalize a permanent relocation assistance policy. The code change ordinance in front of us today extends the current policy for 6 months. However, I want to be clear that we're bringing back a permanent relocation assistance policy on December 6th, and that it's my intention to have a permanent policy in place by the end of this calendar year. I'd also like to especially thank Commissioner Chloe Udaly for her willingness to lead on this issue so early in the year, and frankly, so early in her political tenure. I've sincerely appreciated your partnership, and as the Housing Commissioner, I'm going to continue to value your insights on housing policy. So thank you. I don't know if anybody wanted to say anything else on relocation. Commissioner Udaly?
Hello, everybody. So it seems like yesterday we were here to debate the merits of mandatory relocation as a anti-displacement technique. Here we are today at the end of the temporary date we put on that policy, more convinced than ever that it is the right thing to do for people. We've accomplished a lot this year, but honestly, when I reflect on the last 9 months, relocation stands head and shoulders above anything else that I've been able to accomplish this year, and really makes some of the stresses and sacrifices of this job worthwhile. Since the passing of this policy in February, we've received nonstop calls and emails from renters and landlords alike. Our office feels confident that this policy has absolutely made a difference in the lives of hundreds and possibly thousands of renters. While today's ordinance merely extends this policy another 6 months, I am committed to making it permanent and making it even more effective. I will continue to fight to end displacement and to stabilize renters through multiple strategies, but today this is the best we have, and we owe it to renters to make it the best it can be. Thank you to everyone who came today in the middle of a work day or school day or childcare less day. I know it's really tough to come here in the middle of the day. Actually, it's not the middle. I wish it was the middle. It's still morning. Good morning, everybody. I think it's a clear statement of need when renters take off time from work to make their voices heard. I want you to know I hear you, and I thank you for being here.
Very good. And folks, given the large, large number of people that have signed up for public testimony and acknowledging that people have to get back to work and other issues, let's limit testimony to 2 minutes apiece. My suspicion is with that many people, you will find some people are also making the same comments you are about these two policies. It's okay just to say, I agree with fill in the blank. Or you can say, I disagree with fill in the blank, and that'll help us speed things up. So I'd like to extend a courtesy for folks with disabilities, people with very young children who might like to speak. I also understand that Representative Hernandez is here, Casey Jama is here from Unite Oregon, and former State Rep Shamia Fagan are here. If you'd like to testify, we'd like to have you come up quickly as well.
Mayor, if I may, Daly, before
yes,
we
please.
Hear. I have an amendment to offer for item 1088. It is to remove language in the code that allows an exemption on relocation payments for owners who rent only one unit in the city of Portland.
I will. Commissioner Moose.
Mayor, I'll second it for purpose of discussion.
Commissioner Fish seconds on the amendment for purposes of discussion.
And Mayor, I have a proposed friendly amendment to the amendment. I think I was the original author of this exemption, and in my statement in support of it, I explained that the council had put accessory dwelling units into a special category. We had made special efforts to create incentives for people to build them and maintain them, and we had exempted them from a lot of our rules. So I thought, consistent with that, we should put them in an exemption. I have met with some of the advocates and other folks who care about this issue, and I'm persuaded that the one dwelling unit exception has had unintended consequences. And I think in effect it's a loophole that needs to be closed, but I still believe that accessory dwelling units deserve a protection because the council has said so consistently that we want to encourage them. And I think it's a identifiable and separate class of occupancy that we can address. So my friendly amendment, which I'm going to hand out, simply in lieu of striking one dwelling unit from 30.01.085B, replaces it with in only, quote, a single accessory dwelling unit, end quote. So we would limit the exemption strictly to a single accessory dwelling unit, and I would offer that as a friendly amendment to the Udaly amendment.
Commissioner?
Commissioner, thank you, and thank you for acknowledging that perhaps we didn't know and or consider enough the impact of that original exemption. I agree with maintaining the owner-occupied rule, and I believe ADUs would be included in that. So I just want to be clear, though, ADUs would be exempted, but also owner-occupied shared housing would remain an exemption. Is that?
So to speed this along, she's rejecting your offer.
Well, I'm not rejecting. I'm trying to clarify it, because currently the only exception to RELO is when a rental unit is shared with the owner. It's owner-occupied.
That's not.
Yes, it is. It absolutely is. And we're clear, and an ADU is called an accessory dwelling unit because it is attached as an accessory to that home. So
the owner occupancy requirement is not affected by my friendly amendment.
Okay.
May I just ask a clarifying question as a sponsor? Is this an issue that's being discussed in the committee looking at the permanent rules?
It very well may be, but that committee was set up as a technical advisory committee, and this is a policy decision.
Well, let me be clear. I would like this issue to be on the table for people to address in testimony. It is the council's will how we dispose of the amendment. So I would like to invite, if people want to address this, I would like to hear, and then the council decides whether we're going to take it up today or some later date.
If I might just further comment, this illustrates the reason that we were putting this off to the committee, because there's multiple variations of the amendment already, and it is a more complicated issue, as evidenced by apparently I don't understand the ordinance that was passed.
So why don't we do this in the interest of moving this along, because we have a lot of people who'd like to testify. And Commissioner Fritz, I just want to publicly state that is my preference. I believe we should honor the process we put into place. We established a RELO committee for the purpose of evaluating these kinds of proposals. They are coming back in December with the permanent strategy, and it would be my recommendation that this go to that committee for further evaluation and recommendation to the City Council in December. However, let's have both of these issues on the table here today. Let's hear from the public
on
these issues.
I don't think that your amendment was seconded. I'd like to second the Fish amendment.
So Commissioner Fish moves, Commissioner Udaly seconds. So we now have two amendments on the table, and we'll now open it up to public testimony. 2 minutes each, please.
I have Holly Hansen, who requested to go early, and if anybody else with I'm sorry, Mayor, did you have some other people you said you wanted to go first?
If any of the individuals that I called up are here and they want to go early.
So they are here. Mayor Representative Diego Hernandez is here.
Oh, and I see Shamia here. Very good.
I think you said Casey Jama.
Casey's here. Good.
He's here.
Come on up.
Shamia Fagan
and,
is here.
And anybody with disabilities, children who'd like to go early, please just let the clerk know and we'll accommodate you.
Could I wait?
Sure.
I didn't check my oxygen. I'm in good shape.
Okay, just let us know.
If I run into trouble, left hand.
Perfect. Thank you, sir. Good morning.
All right. Good morning.
Good morning, sir.
Mayor Wheeler, City Commissioners, my name, for the record, my name is Diego Hernandez. I'm a state representative for House District 47 in East Portland, representing neighborhoods like Gateway, Hazelwood, Rosewood, and other East Portland neighborhoods. In my district, families are finding it harder and harder to pay for rent as prices increase and as more and more folks get displaced. Rents continue to increase, and families continue to be forced with difficult decisions. Should I take on this 20% rent increase or move further away? Should I pay rent or my phone bill this month? Should I report the black mold and risk being evicted? This is an emergency, and we need to continue to do everything we can to improve the experiences of renters and families who are experiencing housing instability. In February of this year, you all mandated that landlords in the city of Portland pay relocation assistance to tenants experiencing rent increases of 10%. We are asking you that to lower it to 5%. Thank you for your efforts here at the local level. While we tried to do something with HB 2004 and we failed, we are optimistic that we could continue to do something at the state level. It is reassuring to hear that while extension is through April, council will be voting on a permanent policy later this year. But the time is now, and we are here to ask for permanent changes today. We need to close the loophole, like you all were talking about. I'd urge you to lift the exemption now so that all tenants have the assurance and relocation assistance. Also, with the commitment of developing a hardship appeals program at the six-month review for these landlords experiencing edged cases, we ask that the city base any future or current exemptions on data. And speaking of data, also tracking how many landlords are paying the relocation assistance. We ask that the city immediately invest in outreach and education to get the word out. Thank you.
Thanks, Representative. We appreciate your being here.
Good morning, Mayor Wheeler and Commissioners. My name is, for the record, my name is Casey Chama. I am the Executive Director of Unite Oregon. Thank you so much for having us today here. I'm here to speak and urge you to make the rent relocation assistance ordinance permanent and also to consider expanding the protection of offered by this policy. I think we know that we have housing crisis in our hand, and our community, particularly low-income community, community of color, immigrant refugees, are especially impacted. I also emphasize that the city of Portland must take rent relocation assistance ordinance permanent now with six-month review. Why permanent? Because we know the problem is not going away. It's getting worse, and we don't want to have to come to every few months to push this policy forward. We also urge you that the city must lower the rent increase limit from 10% to 5%. Why? Because people are not only receiving increases in their cost of rent, they are receiving increases in transportation costs, food costs, medical costs. It costs more just to be alive. These increases are not keeping pace with the Portlanders' paychecks. Something has to give. Please do something. The city of Portland also must remove small landlord exemptions. In order to extend tenants this equal protection, let me be clear. Renters who speak English are having a hard time to navigate this system. Imagine if you don't speak English. It's a very, very complex system, and I think we have to close the loophole. With that said, thank you very much, and I'm looking forward to be working with you.
Thank you, sir. We appreciate your being here. Good morning.
Good morning, Mayor Wheeler, members of the council. For the record, my name is Shamia Fagan, former state representative for House District 51, which included a large portion of East Portland, east of 122nd. In 1997, my brother was driving us on I-84 to East Portland to see my mom for the first time in many years. We were being raised by a single parent in Eastern Oregon. My dad and my mom had been struggling with addiction and had been on and off the streets living in East Portland. But she finally had a home and had invited us to come see her. So I remember my brother pulled up to this big, beautiful Victorian-style house with a huge wraparound porch. We were thinking, whoa, Mom, nice house. And she gave us a hug and walked us around to the front steps. But instead of walking up the steps, She dropped down to her hands and knees, and she crawled under the porch and then invited us into her home. And my brother and I dropped down to our hands and knees, and we crawled under the porch behind her. And she had a sleeping bag unzipped to cover the dirt floor, and we spent the day with her there. And like many people experiencing housing insecurity and homelessness, my mom didn't drive around with a U-Haul, so she showed us the one box that she kept with her, which is full of pictures of us and letters from us. I know through your courageous leadership that you took in February that you know what I know, which is that everybody struggling to make a home or keep a home, that's somebody's somebody. That's somebody's mom, that's somebody's nana, that's somebody's friend, that's somebody's brother or uncle or son. So we're here today to ask you to make these changes permanent, because these folks need you to not let the rug be pulled out from under them and be concerned that this might expire, this might sunset. We need these changes to be permanent, and we ask you to make those changes today. Do you want to add anything?
Okay. Out like
Thank
a
you.
Light. Out like a light. Thank you. We appreciate it. It's good seeing you. That's three, please.
We have some people with disabilities. We have Holly Hansen, and I believe we have two more from the other room who came over.
Very good. Good morning.
Oh, hi. My name is Holly Hansen. I live six blocks from here, and I represent the next wave of 5,000 newly homeless people. I live in a subsidized Portland tax credit, Section 42 apartment, and I pay $609 a month rent. It's a regular building, but the units by the trash closet or the elevators that are kind of more undesirable get the tax credit discount. And I'm permanently disabled with a neurological condition, and many of my neighbors are disabled and elderly. Many are young people just starting their careers. We all have been paying our $609 a month. We've been background checked and credit checked. And last month, my leasing agent told me at my rent renewal that the landlord has to reapprove the subsidy that I'm getting for my apartment every 15 years. And then she started in with a hard sell that I should pay $1,200 a month when the subsidy expires because it's better than being on the street. And that was her quote. My subsidy can be ended in 11 years. I have $260 a month every month on average in unreimbursed medical expenses. So $1,200 a month rent is not sustainable. When I moved in, I was told that it was a 100-year subsidy starting when the building was built, which was around 1994. So I planned on having it for 80 years. I spent $5,000 moving here to be with my only daughter in the town of my grandmother's relatives. The apartment was worth $750 per month 5 years ago. Now the landlord can get $1,200. There are 40 units like mine in my building, and we all will need new apartments suddenly. I have a list from Oregon Housing and Community Services, and by my count, there are 112 apartment buildings in Portland. And if each one of those has 40 units, I got my calculator out, and that could be 5,000 new homeless people like me who did nothing wrong. I'm a volunteer, you know, I'm leading a stable life. And so I'm here today trying to stave that off. No one I know has a room for me to rent. I can't do more than a half-hour transit ride due to my disability. I need to live close to my daughter so that she can work and care for me as I age. And I'm just looking for more incentives. I don't want my landlord to find out I was here today and get him mad at me, but I'm hoping that they need more incentives, that clearly they want to dump this program, and I don't have the numbers of how many people this will displace because I don't know if they have more than 40 units, but I'm guessing maybe it's 4,000 people that are going to be the next wave. And then I also am trying to help a friend of mine who is Susan Sammel. She's the caregiver for Jane Sandel, and her husband is Charlie. They're in Portland. They get $1,100 Social Security for the two of them a month, and they're like 85 and 86. Their rent was $998 a month. Now they've lived in their apartment 17 years, but now their rent went up to $1,370 a month, which is, you know, $372 more than their Social Security. And Charlie is 86 and has had two strokes and is deaf. Jane is 85, partially blind, partially paralyzed. They need to be close to their doctors. That's an issue for me. And their apartment is all the way out at Stark and 190th Street, and they still have gang activity there. And she mentioned that it's owned by Templeton. And I have the list. I made copies of everything I said today, and I have the list of the tax credit apartments from the Oregon Housing.
Great. Thank you.
And if I could be directed who to give my documentation
If you could give it to Carla right there, we'd appreciate it.
Okay.
She'll make sure we get copies of all of it and that it's entered into the record.
Good. And I'm just here doing what I can, and if there's anyone in the room today that can help direct me, my disability is all-consuming. I really need time to get back to my health and all of that, but I can't afford to lose my rent and be on the street, so I'm taking time out to fight for my rent.
Wonderful. And we appreciate your being here. Thank you.
Thank you. Can I give what?
Very good. Welcome. Thank you for being here.
Me?
Yes, please.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much for allowing me to speak. My name is Cora Mason, and my family and I have lived at 5819 apartments since June 2nd of 2015. We moved into a two-bedroom apartment on March 5th, 2016. Our rent there in that two-bedroom started out at $1,350 plus electricity each month and was increased to $1,375. On September 14th, 2017, I received notification via stuck outside my our apartment door of a rent increase that is at the end of my November 30th, 2017 lease. That's when it ends. The paperwork includes that my rent will increase from $1,375 plus electricity to $1,512 per month, which is a 9.997% increase. Okay. And then, in addition to that, there will be $20 monthly for garbage and an unknown fluctuating amount for water and sewer each month. They don't know how much it is yet. Okay. So I was never charged before for water, garbage, or sewer. I have no idea of the possible total of these items, and I do know I can't afford these increases. Yet I have no money saved up to relocate my two grandsons and my daughter. My daughter's six-year-old son is autistic. He attends Jason Lee School, where he is in a group with other autistic children. He is doing extremely well. And to move him outside of the group due to moving somewhere out of the community, it would be a tragedy and a travesty. Each one of us living in this family group has a disability and or challenges of some kind. Earlier this year, I had an operation to remove a cancer, and I also had hip replacement surgery. It was also discovered that I have atrial fibrillation, for which I have been prescribed Eliquis, which has a $400 a month copay. I became disabled back in 2003, following open-heart surgery. My heart stopped working, and I was given last rites. Fortunately, after being able to summon an on-call or cardiologist who was able to turn the situation around, I am still here. However, it is not without the damaging side effects of the incident. My daughter has a number of medical challenges as well as my oldest grandson. We have nowhere to turn for money to relocate, yet we cannot afford these unfair monthly increases, and we certainly do not want to be homeless.
Thank you.
Can't imagine carting my family around all over.
No way. Thank you, and we're glad your health has improved. Thank you.
Just a comment on that?
I really appreciate you pointing out that there's a way to get around the 10% by adding on fees that you never had to pay before. So I would suggest that's something that when we get to the permanent rules, we should make something, we should include
Thank
something
you.
About that.
Thank you.
Hi,
Good
folks.
Morning.
I'm Johnny Shaver. I work in housing and homelessness in Montevilla and also in Vancouver with SHARE. But I was here in February to testify about how no-cause evictions were harming my neighborhood. But I'm here today to tell you how they're harming me. 1 week after testifying in February, I received a no-cause eviction. I have no way to prove that it was retaliatory, but I can tell you that it displaced three generations of my family as I take care of my mother and my 8-year-old child and my stepfather at that time. I was not able to get renter's relocation because my landlord situation was very, probably not unique, but interesting. My house was technically owned by a woman in her mid-90s. Her son managed the estate, and while she only owned the one rental property, he has about half a dozen. He was responsible for the sale of the house. He brought a real estate agent into my home, but would not identify him as a real estate agent to me. It was very awkward to have folks walking through my house and have no idea who they were. This has been a huge hit for my family. Without the connections that I have made in my community, I would not have housing right now because I do work in housing and homelessness, and the irony is not lost on me that I cannot afford housing otherwise without the connections I've made in my community. So I'm here today to ask that the relocation ordinance be extended and that the loophole be closed. It is, my landlord made $375,000 on the house that they've owned for, well, since 1950. It was all profit for him, and it was all hardship for me. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. We appreciate it. Next three, please.
We have one more, someone with a child, and
oh,
then
sorry.
We'll go with Alan Kessler and Sean Gillians. You can come on up now, and then they'll be followed by Nicole Phillips, Craig Rogers, and Wayne W.
Good morning.
Hello, good morning. My name is Megan Dorton, and I'm here today to talk to you about my experience as a landlord and to express my support of our renter protections and the expansion and continuance of the relocation ordinance, and to ask that the council close the small landlord loophole. So I, as I said, I'm a landlord. I have a property in Northwest Portland, also in Northeast Portland in Montevilla. And when I found out I was pregnant with this one, my family and I decided that we were going to move from our home in Montevilla down to the next neighborhood in Foster Powell. We found we were looking for some home that was bigger and was closer to a low traffic pathway to school for our soon-to-be kindergartner. And we looked and we found a place, and it was great. It was perfect down the street from the library. It was wonderful. And so we moved because we wanted to. We gave ourselves a lot of time, and we had the money to do it. And it was hell. It was a nightmare. Moving was very, very difficult, even under these great circumstances. And I mention that because for my two tenants, their situations were also had to move before they rented with me, and their situations weren't quite as great. They were forced to move, both of my households, without cause, and they were left facing not only losing their home but losing their neighborhoods. Their kindergartners couldn't go to the school of their choice. Their kindergartners would have to move and change schools. And for them, it was utter chaos. And months for one tenant and years for the other, these households are still facing the legacy of financial difficulties from having to move without sufficient notice and without without sufficient means to do so. Now, in both of these cases, they moved prior to the relocation ordinance being in effect, but it wouldn't have mattered anyway because they were small landlords. So I'm asking you to please consider the effect of the small landlord loophole on the tenants themselves. They are not, though their landlords might be smaller, the effects of them